Hello, Anton.
Hello, Iro.
Good to have you in my podcast. But first, a short message to the viewer. Please subscribe this YouTube channel because you are obviously following this podcast. That's the least you can do. And take it from me. Sometimes in life, it's good to do the thing what is least expected from you. So subscribe the channel, then you can comment and you get a notification when there's a new episode and stuff, blah 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 blah. Great to see you, Anton. Of course, we have been seeing each other. We are on a tour, yes, with the Hell Trio. Maybe we'll talk more about that later. But now let's go to your first pick, your first recommendation. I'm so happy you selected EST, Espion Svensson Trio, for two reasons. One, we both know the trio very well. And we respect their music, and actually we know some players in that band. And number two, I think, and I'm sure you agree with me, their work should not be forgotten. Yeah. And I've talked to some young cats, and you know, I've mentioned Espio Svensson, like really young Jasper. They're like, who? Mm. Who? So it's, you know, It's been a while. Yeah. I mean, Espion died 2008, so no new music. Oh, there was one album or two albums, but you know, so let's keep EST alive.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and they have such a strong legacy.
Yeah.
But as you say, the youngest generation of jazz musicians, perhaps. Well, they don't necessarily know about EST because there's so much new stuff coming out every
and actually it just I just realized that they really had like 10 years, you know, 10 plus years what they, and they achieved a lot during those years, but they came to the scene in the late 90s. First it was Victoria Tolstoy with them, and then it was Espion Svensson Trio, but you know, really 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah, 10 plus years, I would say. Because I remember I was not listening to jazz when I was, you know, I was 16. And I was attending this rock music festival in Småland in Sweden.
Yeah.
Hultsfred Festivalen.
It's attending like as a musician?
No. As a visitor. I just had started playing drums.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, more into the rock scene and punk scene at that time, because that's what I was playing back home in Ängelholm. So I grew up on the west coast of Sweden. But that was my first music festival ever, and all of a sudden I catch myself standing in a tent, and these three guys walk on stage, and it's Espion Svensson Trio playing at a rock festival. I was like, this is. This doesn't seem like the normal act on this at this festival, and then they played a concert there, and that's how I was introduced to EST, or Espion Svensson Trio as they were called back then.
And the year was
97,
so that was the beginning of
I guess
that.
Because if they had that kind of fame already in 97, because I knew they'd been, I mean, their first record, is that from 94 or something?
Could be. Yeah. We can look at. So that was been, they were on with Sony first.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
true.
Yeah.
But then and then after that I just got hooked and followed them, you know, and saw them live a year after when I was attending pre music school.
Yeah.
And I mean, the reason why I've chosen this this song, which is Thelonious Monk Bemsha Swing, is that Well, it just spoke to me, and I was so curious what those chords in the middle were. I was like, what's he doing? Because I was quite fresh in my music studies.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the ears to kind of transcribe it.
Okay.
So after a concert in Helsingborg, they were playing at a venue called Tivoli. No grand piano, so he was playing Rhodes.
Oh, really?
They played a couple of Rhodes gigs, around that time.
Okay.
So this is, let me see, this must be, one or two years after.
Yeah.
So after the concert, I went up to Isbjørn and said, excuse me, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Those chords in Bemsha Swing, what is that? He was like, and of course, so kind and polite. And so we went to the Fender Rhodes,
yeah,
and he showed me those. Oh, you mean those Coltrane changes? Yeah. Well, I didn't know what Coltrane was. So I was like, perhaps those,
Yeah.
So he showed them to me, and I remember looking at his hands and trying to memorize, okay, I have to remember this. And then I,
Wow.
I went home and...
Such a good memory, and great to hear, that the kind response from Espion, but that was the guy he was, He was a very nice person. Well, people who don't know, maybe we should explain quickly how big EST became. I mean, I can't recall any other European jazz becoming so popular and getting such a wide audience than this Swedish trio.
Yeah.
First, they were among us, playing the same festivals, playing the same stages. Even my trio shared the stage with them many times. But
yeah, you had a couple of double bills.
Yeah, double bills.
Many
double bills in Germany until they decided that no more double bills for them, no more sharing the stage. Yeah. They got really big, and they really started reaching out of jazz scene audiences, pop rock audiences, and it was such a great trio. Just piano, bass, drums. The bass player Dan using a lot of electronics, and lots of bow solos. And
that's his signature sound.
That's his signature sound. Espion did some electronics with the Steinway, some some echo things, and Magnus Öström had something.
Absolutely,
some electronics there, but very. It was still acoustic jazz trio, and it's kind of phenomenal to think that they really, were so much attracting people who never listen jazz.
Yeah. And playing for standing audiences as well, and
that's
visuals.
Right.
I remember we were touring with Jazz Kamikaze, and this was. This might have been 2008, actually, early 2008, at a festival in France, where we played with Jazz Kamikaze, and EST played that evening as well. So we got to hear them that evening, with big visuals and taking it to the next level.
That's right. They hired a light guy, two light guys. They had their own.
They had a crew,
They had a crew
as a jazz band, and that's very rare.
Yeah.
And they were just about to break the American market, right?
That's
as well.
Yes.
As the only, as of the first European. Band, jazz band.
Yes, they did many, many showcase gigs at the stage, and it was just starting to happen for them until Espion died in a diving accident 14th of June 2008. Some things about this track, very cool bass riff.
Right.
Yeah,
it's so hooky.
Yeah, it's so hooky. I also like the little percussion things here and there, which are obviously overdubbed, or not.
I'm not sure, because I know that it's Esbjorn playing this cachixe, I think it is. It's kind of shaker, Brazilian.
Yeah.
And or maybe it's just a...
We say just egg.
Egg, yeah.
Yeah, but maybe it's the bigger one.
Yeah, but he's like a... it's obvious to me that it's played quite freely and spontaneously, and so it might be just, you know, when they actually, we can ask Dan or Magnus
about this next time. How was it done?
Because it's kind of a little bit hippie vibe over it. Just like, okay, now I'm going to play a little bit of
That's right. Shaker. Yeah. I should listen it more carefully. Just to hear that. Is he touching the piano at the same time?
I don't believe so. I think it's in the in the breaks, you know, where it's only drums and that's right. bass.
And this is maybe I didn't mention this. The name of the album is, and of course this is linked with the episode, Esbjörn Svensson Trio Plays Monk, album from year 2000. That's what it's called, and it is on ACT.
It's not from 2000 though.
Okay, that's what Spotify says.
Spotify. We can't really believe it. I was fooled the other day with Daniel Lanois album, but it's from 97, I believe. 96 or 97.
Okay. And then somebody feed it into Spotify year 2000,
and didn't bother to make sure that the year was right.
Yeah, quite unusual album from there. I don't remember any other theme album, of cover songs, because from that on they did their own material, live or studio. But I think this is the only covers album.
Yeah.
Very interesting album.
Yeah, and I mean, it just shows Esbjörn's skills of arranging and making it more, easily accessed for a non-jazz listener.
That's right.
And that's one of the high qualities that
it is.
He had. And
it is. I mean, the groove, like on this track, the groove is there all the time. You know, very clear and very easy. He's taking up the solo, building it up very slowly. You know, not like showing off, but then in the end, he shows that he has the chops. You know, but not all the time. Very good dramaturgy in the piano solo, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a very cool kind of a free part.
Yeah,
it's quite
a long tune as well. It's 6-7 minutes or something.
Yeah. And that's that takes skills to build a long solo. You know, because not all have it. Did you hear them live since that rock festival?
Yeah.
I mean Kamikaze thing in the end, but
exactly. And also when I asked about the the chords,
so that you was saw them many times.
I might have seen them a handful of times all in all.
Yeah. And then later on, we played together with Dan.
Irurantala Super Trio.
Super Trio, which only did two or three gigs. So that's how super it was.
But that was really fun. Yeah, that was
just before COVID. Yeah. And then did you get to know Magnus Öström at some point?
Yes, we have met along the way at festivals and at baggage belts.
That's right.
In airports. Yeah. So. Because Mary Snisset, who I've played with for 20 years, he did the East East Symphony at the same time as you did it.
Yeah.
So he became friends with Magnus.
That's right.
Of course. So through that as well.
I think your background with Magnus is similar somehow. I mean, musically.
Mm-hmm.
There is the knowledge and respect for jazz, but your approach is
more progressive,
and rocky. I would say. Both of you. So yeah.
Great. I mean, and needless to say, Magnus inspired me so much in my, because he's a generation over me.
Yes,
and when I. God, I love his playing.
Yeah,
and it really sent me into a direction.
That's good.
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing to hear a European musician being inspired by another European.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not only American.
It's not only the American show that we are running here. What do you think? Where would they be nowadays if Esbjörn would have got more time?
I was thinking about that yesterday, actually. They would have been huge. And I think, because they were, as you say, they were really moving towards a more rocky
sound. Stadium gigs, maybe.
Who knows? But then they needed to change the music even more, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
Needless to say, Esbjörn had a clear vision of where that band was going. And
that's right. I had my last chat with Esbjörn exactly 2 months before he died. So they came to April Jazz in Espoo, here in near Helsinki, and I went to see them, and I went to the backstage, and I had two things in my mind. First, I wanted to ask him to play the Mozart double concerto, Mozart piano concerto number 9, E flat. He said he politely said no to that because he said that there are so many projects and the trio is, you know, is so I understood. And then he asked how I'm doing, and I told him that, well, Trio Töket is now over. I have this Irrantala new trio, Das Neues Trio, which was kind of over, already over, or, you know, almost over by then. And then I said that I have no label. I don't really have anything in my mind. I have no future. I'm going to live under the bridges from now on. And then he took a piece of paper and gave Sigi Loch phone number to me.
So that's how it started.
After 2 months after that, we got the terrible news. He's dead. He has drowned near Stockholm, diving accident. And then I waited more than a year, but I had the piece of paper. Then I called. But that's how it started.
He
did this last favor for me.
Yeah. That must have. I mean.
Yeah. Now I think our album, which is coming out in May, will be my 14th act album. But the start was that moment at the backstage.
It's a good stint you've been having there.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, Esbjörn, and thanks for your music and your good spirit and helping. And I know he was really popular among the Swedish musicians as well, organizing Swedish jazz musicians. And tennis tournaments, and just like one of those the captain of a ship type of personalities. Such a nice guy. Yeah. Well, we'll miss him. Luckily, we have his music, and that's alive. Your second pick is Avishai Cohen. The album is At Home, and the track is called Punk. And we found the PDF of this, which I will of course attach with the episode. I'm just showing to the camera. This is how high tech we are here. This is the PDF. Here you can see the main theme. But open the PDF. It's in the where I. Oh, now I'm getting message. My wife is. Are you still doing the bullshit? No. No, but here it's really good notation, and this is a really exciting tune. One of your favorites. I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a the reason I chose it is because of the benchmark that it is in my. In my playing, discovering this kind of way to play and to divide a bar, because when I heard this the first time, and the one introducing this to me was also a fellow friend of ours, Morten Lund, the drummer, because he was my teacher at the Rhythmic Music Conservatory in Copenhagen, where I started in 2003.
Yeah.
He wasn't teaching at the school, so I requested to have him. Mm-hmm. That was also getting phone numbers. So I called Morten Lund.
Yeah.
I'd listened to him, for a couple of years.
Just quickly, Morten Lund will be a guest in this podcast series. Just wait for a couple of weeks after Anton. I'm gonna chat with him in Copenhagen in 2 weeks. Yeah. Please continue.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. So he and we had so nice lectures together. It was a lot of just playing together, and he showed all his nice stuff. And
okay.
we had a really, really good vibe, and are still good friends today.
So two drum kits and mostly playing together.
Yeah,
like he would start something, and then you trade, you know, like, solos.
Have you seen this trick? I was like, oh. What is it?
Okay. But the playing goes along all the time, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that unusual method of drum teaching?
No, I don't think... With drummers, it makes so much sense. I mean, any instrument, really, that you teach out, just to have...
Not all rooms have two together. Pianos like I have here, but okay.
But he played this tune to me, you know, check this out, kind of, and I was like, okay, what? I thought it was in five.
Yeah,
because it sounds you know. It's basically take five.
That's right, and it sounds like odd times, but it is in four. And it is in four.
You know, so I was like, okay. You know, there's these eight bars of just bass in the start, and then when the drums and piano comes in. You know the emoji where the brain?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And this is in 2005.
Yeah.
It totally blew my mind. And I was like trying to, oh, what is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, God, I can't. And then, because Morten obviously said, do you know what this, what meter this is in? and I could not figure it out. And he said, it's four.
It's four?
What?
And that was before the PDF, before the notation.
Yeah, I got this from Avishai's webpage. He sells all his music there.
Okay.
But I have transcribed this earlier because I played it live as well. But I couldn't find that old score. I was really looking in my archive at home, but I couldn't find it. But
But you notated it yourself. You transcribed it.
Yes, absolutely. I loved that issue.
That's not easy.
Harmonically, it's not too complicated.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's a fast melody, but it's only broken, you know, chords.
G minor, first one. Yeah, yeah. So a little bit like Got a Match from G Korea, but 10 times more complex.
Because the rhythm is you know, within this 4-4 bar, 16 notes, it's 5-5-6.
Yeah.
So you have like... So the 4-4 bar is divided up in three, you can say, but a little uneven three.
Yeah.
And when you only hear the bass in the start, you can hear it as a swing five, five.
Is it Ronnie Caspi on drums on this track? No.
No, it's Mark Giuliana.
Mark Giuliana, okay.
Who played with Avishai. So this album is with a piano player called Sam Barsh.
Okay.
And he played in the trio from 3 to 6 or something.
Okay.
And I think Mark continued for another few years.
Okay.
And Shai Maestro started playing in the trio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is Mark Giuliana. And he also a huge inspiration for me.
Yeah.
And the way how to play... this kind of music, it really, and he was in Copenhagen as well for some shows with Avishai, and I got to have a lesson with him and got to hang out with him.
Okay, I like the pan sound in the drum solo. He's got this like a pot or something.
Yeah, he has some kitchen.
And that's you don't hear kind of new sounds during the drum solo. solo every day, especially in the jazz idiom, you know. Exactly. I appreciate it. I mean, you have it, you have the bongos, and mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you you're hitting the mic, like in the Jyväskylä gig two nights ago. Some you can do that with Shure mic, you know.
Yeah.
They never broke.
No, you can.
But it's so refreshing to hear new sounds from the drum kit. Yeah, and this this guy Mark
Giuliani, and he's 24 at this time.
Yeah,
when they recorded this album.
Yeah.
So yeah, and everybody living in New York. I wish I came over to New York in like mid 90s, I think. Worked as a construction worker, but played on the you know, on the sidewalks of New York. And then he started playing a lot of Cuban music. He met Danilo Perez.
Yeah.
And started playing with him.
Okay.
Played a lot of Cuban music, and then he started in Chicoria's band.
Oh, okay. Mm. All right.
The septet that he had there.
So he arrived from Israel. That's his home country.
Exactly. From Israel.
All right.
And then he played in Chick's trio with Jeff Ballard for quite a few years.
Yeah.
Those Blue Note concert.
That's right. Yeah.
That's good also stuff. Like...
yeah. But
heaven for me.
But this must be you know, one of the beginnings for your love of kind of complex rhythms, because I went to your concert with Marius Neset just a few weeks ago here in Helsinki, and you have lots of odd meters and kind of there was one or two tunes in the concert that I couldn't tell what is the time, you know. I like commenting, this could be 9 or 4
or something else. Or 4.
Or 4. That's
the fun game with odd time signatures and you know, overlayers in rhythms.
Yeah. So it comes from this track and maybe Zappa. Have you listened a lot of Zappa?
No. I haven't. He hasn't been you know, a thing throughout my life.
Okay.
But way before this, before I heard this Avishai track, I've been interested in odd time signatures and quirky rhythms.
Yeah.
But this was just another way to do it, you know.
Dividing
it like this.
Yeah.
2-5 groupings and then 6, you know.
Yeah. And still write it down as 4-4.
Yeah.
It's really
because that's, you know, that's where it is.
So what artist what artists did you check out in terms of odd meters? I'm just curious. Turkish or
no, you know, but you know, more Brad Meldow, you know, introducing album.
Yeah. Yeah, he's which, got yeah.
Yeah, I think that came out in 96 and or 7 something as well.
Yeah.
Totally blew my mind as well.
Okay.
And I because they they play that standard, what's it called, Spring. You can't
Spring,
yeah, something with
spring can really hang you up the most, is one, but Spring is here.
You can't believe in Spring or something.
Ah, da 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 da.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of that standard.
Please give the name of the standard in the comments. Thank you. Okay. So yeah. Okay. So you started practicing 9/8, 11, all these things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, sounding shit in the start, as we do with everything when we have to start, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's just about spending time on it.
Sting, 10 Summoner's Tales.
Yeah,
there's some cool.
Oh yeah,
5, 4, 7, and 9.
Yeah. Yes. He
around same time, late 90s, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Because when I was in the military in 2000, I kind of got introduced to those albums by Sting.
Yeah.
And Vinny.
Yeah.
Kaluta. Yeah.
And then later on, you joined Marius Neset, and he obviously has a love for this. Yeah.
And we were four students that found each other at the Rhythmic Conservatory.
Yeah.
Marius Nisset, the piano player Magnus Hjort, and the bass player Peter Eld. And we started a band called People Are Machines, where we played, so to speak, not only in 4/4. So okay. We love to explore that together.
Yeah.
Complex rhythms. And so we had so much fun. That was the school in the school.
People Are Machines.
Yeah.
Any recordings of that?
Yeah, yeah. We recorded two demos, that we was still, you know, burning CDs and making my own cover. We just took a picture with the school's digital camera, put it in the computer, and just made a.
But can we hear it nowadays? Is it in Spotify?
Yeah, I think there's two things on Spotify. Not the demo, but an album and a live recording from Gecho in Spain, because they have this, I think they still do it, jazz competition.
Okay.
Every year in the Basque country.
Okay.
Close to Bilbao.
Okay.
We attended that competition and won it.
Ah.
Yeah. And okay. Marius, of course, got both the. The audience's prize and the jury's prize.
And all of you got $1 million cash.
I mean, we could just step back and enjoy life after that. No, that was start of our music studying days in Copenhagen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, just before that, I'm curious about your upbringing and your childhood. Any musicians in your family?
Yes, my mother. She was a classical musician, played cello, piano, and singing.
Okay. And your mother is the Swedish one?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, as Marius Nisset introduces you on the concerts, he says that Anton Eger is half Swedish, half Norwegian, now living in Copenhagen, which is really precise. Yeah. I just wonder, is that his way of saying it, or is that a request from you? You want to be introduced by half and half?
I think that's probably his decision, but yes, I would like to be introduced as it is, because
that's right.
I am half Swedish, half Norwegian. Swedish mother, Norwegian father, born in Oslo, and now been living in Copenhagen since 2003.
Yeah,
so Denmark is the place where I've been living the longest time.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm quite Danishified. In my mindset.
A great new Dane. But when did you start? What was the first introduction to music or drumming?
My first introduction to music was singing in the evenings by the piano.
Same here.
With my mother.
Yeah.
That was obviously something. I can still remember that.
Yeah.
Just
a cappella with no piano. With piano.
So she was comping and we were, singing children's songs.
Yeah. Pippi Longstrom.
For instance. But it was a lot of Norwegian tunes at that time.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so and we did that pretty much every evening before bedtime.
Yeah.
So she was really good at taking care of that.
That's right.
And I guess she enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
Sit and sing with her son.
Yeah. And the first 5 years of your life, that's when the person is formed, as Freud said.
So they say.
But then you moved to Venezuela.
Yes, but before that, to Bucharest in Romania. In 1985, my father, he worked for a Norwegian company, Norsk Hydro.
Yeah.
Norsk Hydro.
Yeah.
And he got offered a job in Bucharest in in the 80s, Nicolae Ceausescu's dictator
regime. The last years of Ceausescu. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was assassinated in 89, right?
Yeah.
So, and this was 85, so it was his heyday, kind of, I guess.
Yeah.
So we lived there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then my father took his family and moved to Venezuela, Caracas.
Caracas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 87.
How many years there?
We were supposed to live there for 3 years.
Yeah.
But after 1.5 years, our family was in a plane crash just outside Caracas coast, or Venezuela's coast, in a little island called Los Roques. So it was just a small Cessna plane. We were 8 people in the plane, and during landing the pilot had to go up again and lost control of the plane, so it crashed, and my friend who was 10 years at the time, I was 8, my little brother, he was almost 4, my friend, he got us out of the plane, because he was the only one not getting unconscious. So that's why.
And then you lost your parents, and your friend lost his parents.
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
It wasn't his parents. That was the other adult couple.
Oh,
that was
okay.
Friends of my my parents.
Yeah,
yeah, and the pilot. So there were five grown-ups getting killed in that plane crash, and 3 kids survived because of my friend Christian, who was able to have the courage to drag us out.
Yeah, yeah. From already a burning plane exploded.
Then it exploded right after he got
in
us out.
In front of your eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. I was blacked out. I can't remember anything after the impact.
Okay.
But I had my eyes open and I was talking, but got quite hurt in the crash.
Yeah, your skin is still burned.
I got burn marks, third degree burn marks over my left side of the body from top to toe.
Yeah.
And I got my leg crushed by a big box that fell down during the impact. So I
How long did it take to get help? Can you?
I can't remember these details. I've been told them, and there's this report as well around the plane crash, but I can't remember.
Okay,
but it was out on an island, you know, landing on a beach.
It
wasn't really any airport, but.
And 3 children there. 1 4, you were 8, and your friend was
10.
And okay.
Yeah, he had a lot of courage to be able to, you know, assemble his brain in situation.
Yeah.
It's quite fascinating.
Do you remember the moment you told me this first time?
No, I don't.
Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
We were about to start our first gig together with this super trio, and I didn't know you at all. You know, we had one rehearsal, and then we had this gig, and the city was Braunau.
Ooh, yeah.
Everybody can check from the Wikipedia what's Braunau famous for. I'm not gonna say it now. So we were, you know, we had some jokes about that, but then you were warming up, and this is like 4 minutes before going on stage. You were warming up with your t-shirt, and I saw your hands. I saw the burning marks in your hands. And I said, oh, what have you been in a burning house? What happened? I thought it's something recent. Mm-hmm. And then you quickly told me this story that you lost your parents in a plane crash, in an exploding plane in Venezuela. And then the guy said, now it's time to go. And that was the first time we played again. I will always remember that moment, hearing that story just before the concert.
Right, right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm sure that you had some questions after the stage.
Yeah, yeah, on stage. Yeah, play first.
Oh, that's nice. Too.
But. I mean, one can't even imagine how tragical that that would have been. But maybe music was something that
has helped. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
That was later on, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It was. But of course, music is such an essential part of me just existing and being you know, being able to express feelings and thoughts.
That's right.
Through that, it's
I have heard from Morten Lund actually that you and Marius Neset, you were the two that really you really practiced during the Rytmiska Konservatorium years. I mean, you were known as the guys who barely left the rehearsal room.
Really?
Yeah. Did you have a routine like I'm gonna do
no.
4 hours of this and no?
No.
No.
Okay. Because I've always preferred to practice with a band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we did that a lot with People Are Machines.
Yeah.
Just staying at the school until they until we were thrown out, you know.
Yeah.
At 10 p.m. But it, I mean, obviously I did practice on my own as well because we need to check out stuff, but not as much as, you know, maybe I should or whatever. I just did what I liked, and prioritizing playing with musicians and trying all these metric things out in a context. Obviously you need to check it out yourself so you don't fuck it up for the others. You know, everybody has a responsibility. But okay, so Morten said that well, Marius, he's practiced a lot, like very, and he still does, you know, even if he has two kids and you know, a dad, he still practices.
And you actually revealed a lot by saying that they you got kicked out from the like 10 o'clock because I mean, not all students stay until 10 o'clock in the school practicing. So you did. So maybe,
And
but it was fun. It
And we had each other.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
that's we right. cooked dinner together and went to jam sessions.
Yeah,
because that was also. So such a nice environment and a platform for us at that age that Copenhagen provided so many jam sessions. That's pretty much every day, you know.
Yeah.
At least four or five days out of the week you could and you can still find a jam session that often in Copenhagen. So it's great.
And then
it's
you had a period city. You played percussion in the orchestra. Was that the army service or
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was so I started playing classical. Well, to start with, I just, you know, played in a marching band, played cymbals, and with my punk bands back home in Sweden.
Yeah.
So it was those two things paralleled, and punk and rock. And at high school, my drum teacher, he said, well, he recommended me to play classical percussion. And I was like, really? I want to play more kits.
But
no, you should try out a classical percussion because that gives you a good foundation for reading music. And, you know, also, he kind of saw that to make most sense for me.
Okay.
And I did that for quite a few years and applied to the Norwegian, well, because I when I played cymbals in this marching band, we were in
no 9-4, no 9-11, no odd meters there. Yeah,
we were in Globen on a field trip, and saw the military tattoo there, and I saw His Majesty's King's Guard from Norway, and how superior they were in their exercises.
Yeah.
So I kind of I'm gonna apply for that when I'm doing my military service in 4 years or whatever it was. So I was there in His Majesty's King's Guard for 11 months in year 2000.
Yeah.
And fun fact here, I mean, you know this, but for the listeners, this is where I see Iiro Rantala for the first time.
Unbelievable.
Right?
In Finland.
In Finland. Because we were attending Hamina, a military tattoo.
Yeah.
To make a performance there. During the... one of those evenings, we had an evening off. The whole military guys, we were just, you know, that was a big, big thing when when you could actually go in civilian clothes and have some beers.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
Yeah. That didn't happen very often, so we were really psyched about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of a sudden, I find myself in a big, big tent on a square in Hamina, and... being exposed for this band called Trio Töykeet.
Yes.
And that also, talking about benchmarks, you know, wow, this is, because this is before I started playing jazz.
Yeah.
So Trio Töykeet has been a kind of a gateway into jazz also for me, or into whatever I'm playing now.
Yeah.
So after the concert, I found a lot of your CDs in the music stores in Helsinki.
But did we have a chat then?
No.
Oh really? Okay. Wow.
No, I didn't. I didn't. No.
Wow.
I would have remembered.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
But yeah.
2000. So 2000. That was already 2000. The 12th year of Trio Töykeet then.
Yeah.
So we had been together because I was 18 when we started. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was. It's and now, you know. Now we're playing together. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, and let's not hide the fact that after your kind request, we have now two, three Trio Töykeet compositions in our set now, in the kind of arranged in a different way. But and I'm very happy to play those, because I mean, without your request, I would never, you know, have taken those things.
Right.
But now it feels natural to play some of those tunes, not all of them, but you know, just, you know, sprinkle around a couple of them, and people love them, and some people remember them, and
right. It makes so much sense to let them live on, and play them, because it's great compositions, and
thank you.
I really enjoy playing all of them.
Yeah.
It's it's so much you. Right, and it's your compositions.
Yeah,
they should live on.
Yeah.
And now they can. Now they can.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the strong American mainstream tradition in Copenhagen, which is a fact. I mean, there is there is this thing, because Dexter Gordon moved there, and many Americans, and Niels Henning, Oster Pedersen played with everybody, and there is it's one of the, you know, capitals of American tradition in Europe. But was that a thing for you? Did you get hooked with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Because nowadays you don't sound like that.
No. I probably don't. But I definitely dug into that.
Yeah.
And you know, and we all did in our community. But like, it maybe was more in the style of Branford Marsalis Quartet. That was like something that we were just worshipping at the time, and Wynton Marsalis, you know, all the things with Jeff Tane Watts and those metric
Kenny
stuff.
Kenny Kirkland on piano,
in the early days, and then Joey Colorazzo,
that's right,
took over after Kenny died.
Yeah,
so that that quartet with Eric Reeves, Jeff Tane Watts, and Joey Colorazzo and Branford Marsalis, they released this Love Supreme suite live from. From Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And that's like, that was also one of the things that we listened a lot to, and, you know, transcribed and played as well.
Okay.
Together.
Okay.
And saw them live, you know.
Yeah. And what about the the moment where you started making your own things, you're developing your own sound. Can you remember how it started? I don't think no one in the jazz schools are told that, now forget everything, just do your own thing, because that's not part of the jazz education. The jazz education is to give the history and the knowledge and, you know, how it's been done. But how did it happen for you? When did you start developing your own little things, which, I mean, you sound very personal nowadays. Were you encouraged for that by the teachers, or was it just that it came along with the different bands?
Yes, I think so. And I've always been composing ever since I started playing music.
Yeah.
And writing for my own bands. A funk band at a time called Schönstil Funkies, like a nine-man band. And I've wrote a lot of music for that. And and later for People Are Machines and Jazz Chemicals and all those bands that I've been playing in.
Yeah.
So I've always been an active band member and composer.
Yeah.
And then, I guess along with that, I've always been experimenting, having small percussion things.
Yeah.
And now I've come to a place where bongo drums are and woodblock are it's just part of my setup now in every band I play.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In my drum rider, it's always that.
Yeah.
So whatever band I play with, that's the setup.
Okay.
It's jazz or rock or electronic music.
And do you always get the bongos when you're on tour?
Yes. Well, yeah, because bongos are not so hard to find.
Okay.
It's not too demanding. And and two snares, rack tom and a floor tom.
Yeah.
And six cymbal stands. So it's kind of a big setup.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's, I like to have the same kind of sounds, when I sit behind the kit.
Yeah.
I know how the bass drum sounds. I know how the first snare sounds, muffled, low pitch disco snare, and then a high pitch snare, and then fairly lowly, low-tuned toms, and my own cymbals. So that's like, because then I know exactly how it sounds when I press the different buttons.
Yeah,
and I guess that, you know, because that's quite natural. We want to know how our instrument sounds, if it's saxophone or piano or drums.
Yeah,
so that we can kind of, because then it's easier to produce the music.
Yeah.
While it's happening.
Yeah. So for you, the personal approach for your solos and drumming overall, it comes from the setup also?
A lot.
Yeah, okay.
Because then I'm kind of, okay, I know my sounds. I have my sounds here.
And you play with hands quite a lot, yeah.
I really appreciate that, because it's so nice to kind of just, everything becomes light and you can... I love this percussive element of even if you have, you know, it's mainly drum kit.
Yeah.
But then just switch gear.
And Okay. All right.
Really like that.
And you seem to be very comfortable as a sideman and as a leader. You do both.
Yeah.
Most of the drummers are sidemen, you know, going from project to project. But you do both.
I do both.
Yeah.
And I love bands.
Yeah.
I've always been a band guy.
Yeah.
And because it's just so nice to share both ups and downs together.
That's right. Yeah.
Rather than alone.
Yeah. It was just two nights ago, we were in Jyväskylän, we were learning to whistle one of my phrases, and that was impulse. Yeah. you went octave up there. I'm just, you know, telling to the audience that there was an impulse from you that you wanted to include this phrase in the concert, and suddenly we find me and Connor Chaplin, we find ourselves learning this on stage. But this is so you're not afraid to speak up in the bands, you know. Many sidemen don't do that, but you if you want something, you go for it.
I do, because I can't really hold myself back when I'm in a musical context where I hear something.
Yeah.
Then I would like to share my thoughts, basically.
Yeah.
and suggest it.
Yeah. And this is a good thing. This is a good thing. Yeah. Because many people don't bother, maybe, and you know, they And you have that freedom on Marius Neset Band, probably, that you can, everybody can speak up and say, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Marius is such a good band leader in the way that he lets everybody be themselves, yet he still has a very clear idea where the music is going. So that combination is perfect as band leader.
That's right, yeah. Tell me, how did Arcadia start?
It actually grew out of Morten Schant's Godspeed, which was a trio that Marius played in.
Okay,
so
yeah.
Keyboards, drums, and a saxophone.
Yeah.
And then after Marius, this British saxophone player, Josh Arculeo, played for a couple of years. And we were in Asia, touring, and having really, really nice time. Cut to pandemic. And we couldn't fly Josh over to Denmark, and we were getting offered all these obscure gigs at celebrity parties and weird things.
Okay.
So we played it as a duo.
Okay.
Basically.
Yeah.
And then. We played more and more concerts and figured out that this actually works very well. So should we make it into a duo instead?
Yeah.
And that's where Morten changed the name, and it became a band where we both
Arcadia.
Are.
Morten Schantz from Jazz Kamikaze. That's
correct.
Okay, yeah. So people, this duo is at April Jazz. 25th of April. Don't miss it. It's your first time in Finland.
Yes,
with
it's
Arcadia.
Our baptism in Finland.
Yeah, you should go, and I will remind you in social media. So
kind of you.
Yeah.
Thank
so,
you.
I used to have a band with electric guitar and a beatbox. This was 2008-2009, and I can remember the feeling. And some talks with managers and promoters saying, what is this? Where should I put this? Is this jazz? You must have this thing ongoing with Arcadia. But can you now I'll just tell us what sort of venue would be like a dream venue for you, or are you flexible? Of course, in April Jazz you'll play at the Louhisali, which is a sitting down, very nice club, actually club hall, small hall vibe. Yep. But I've seen some videos from Copenhagen. You play for the dancing audience, because I mean it's there is some jazz elements, of course, but for ordinary people. It sounds like a disco duo, right?
Yeah.
There's lots of disco elements.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So where are you aiming with this?
Where are we aiming with this? Well, I think we love to play both kind of venues.
Yeah.
Because we are jazz musicians, both of us, and there are jazz elements in our music.
Yeah.
But it's kind of broken disco. We give them the carpet that they can walk comfortably on, but all of a sudden it will be pulled under your feet, so you don't know where you are.
Yeah.
And then we're back, you know.
Yeah.
Giving the carpet again.
Yeah.
So, and when you're playing for a sitting audience, they will pay more attention to details, and you can kind of go down that alley.
That's right.
But when you play at
outdoor party.
Yeah, a party.
Yeah,
you know, at 1 a.m. in the morning, and
yeah,
then you kind of need to play something suitable for a party audience,
yeah,
that have been, you know, yeah, partying for many hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like if it was a DJ.
That's right. You know, yeah, yeah, yeah. And for the jazz labels, this is maybe they don't. Yeah,
that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've all had that challenge also in other bands that I play in, because
yeah,
it's always some kind of fusion.
Yeah,
I find myself in, because yeah, I have such a broad music taste, and that kind of influences all the bands that I play in, and yeah, the way I play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So sometimes, yes, it falls between two chairs. it's too weird for both parts, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you're consistent and just continue with what you love and believe in,
mm-hmm,
and just being persistent with that, eventually you will be heard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think nowadays it's really difficult for any musician to say that, oh, I got something which is totally new.
Right.
But there are things that you can say, I have now a new combination,
yeah,
and I think you have a new combination, and that's unique. You know. So check out Arcadia and. Your music is in the internet.
Yes.
I mean, there are the Spotify tracks and some videos.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's an album on Spotify, and also a live album.
Yeah.
From the Danish radio concert hall.
That's right.
Yeah, and a bunch of videos.
What about the Bhutan gig?
Yeah, that was a surreal experience,
yeah,
for sure. Finding yourself all of a sudden playing at the national stadium in Bhutan on the national day,
yeah,
in front of 35,000 people, with an invitation from His Majesty the King of,
yeah,
Bhutan. Yeah, strange. Sliding doors all of a sudden.
Yourself
there.
Big in Bhutan. Yeah.
Big in Bhutan.
How many people live in Bhutan?
700,000.
Oh, and you play for 35,000.
Yeah. And that's like what, 5% of the of the population that, wow, was there.
Well, then you can really say big in Bhutan. You know. Wow.
It was a great experience.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful, beautiful country and beautiful, warm, welcoming people.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Last night you went to a jam session here in Helsinki.
Yes,
good
I did.
Vibes
at Harju.
At Harju.
Yeah.
Harju Kasi Kahdeksan. That's the 8.
Yeah. Lovely place. Such a good environment.
Yeah.
And a lot of young jazz players.
Yeah.
And I was amazed by the level.
Yeah.
So many good players.
Yeah.
A lot of good drummers. A lot of, yeah, good bass players.
Yeah.
Good piano players, and really impressed by it.
Yeah. There's, I think for me, there is many things to worry about jazz, but not the level of the young players.
What are you worried about, Iiro?
I'm worried about the audience, the lack of the audience. That's I'm really worried about. But I'm kind of, I have a feeling that I'm not sharing this concern with many people, which is weird, because I see like here in Helsinki, when I go to the opera, it's, yeah, full, you know, La Traviata, Magic Flute, the same works, you know, brilliant, genius music. It's always full, you know, 1500 people, and the Helsinki Music Center, Radio Symphony, Helsinki Philharmonic, full. You know, every concert, Brahms, Sibelius.
But it's because it has a cultural status to attend those kind of concerts, right?
Yes.
Which jazz does not necessarily have,
yeah,
in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, but then I think some jazz musicians, they're happy to play for 25 people or 32, including the mother and the girlfriend. And, yeah. You know, but I'm not. I'm worried, and not even mentioning the popularity of pop music, which is like, you know, stadium. You know, so I'm worried. I'm not worried about the players, and I'm really happy about the fact that the young cats are willing to go to jam sessions. That's really healthy. You know, without the jam sessions, I mean, nobody's getting paid, but without the jam sessions, I would be even more worried. But there are jam sessions in many cities, and I just feel we have to have a better artist audience relationship. We should focus on that. But I don't know how.
Well, I mean, the concerts that we've been playing with Hell Trio have been very well attended and sold out in Jyväskylä. And
that was my
and
method.
Also here in Helsinki at G-Live Lab.
That's right, it was sold out, yeah.
And I found the audience to be very mixed in age.
Yeah, they are. So, and, yeah. And then we have our audience in Germany also, but that's where I've been focusing.
And they tend to be a bit older.
They're older. But from the start, my method was to have some funny announcements and make it a entertaining evening, not really changing the music at all. I'm not making jazz for dummies or, you know, not really taking anything out from the music, but just to entertain them a little more. And then I get these comments that, I've never been to a jazz concert, but this was a fun evening. I'm gonna come again.
Yeah.
So I think there's something about the relationship between audience and jazz that needs improving. Mm-hmm. But at least we are talking about it. And now I kick the camera for the third time. It is. Has the world become a better or a worse place during your lifetime, Anton?
Well, obviously, I can only see it from my own perspective.
Yeah, this is the question.
Which is the point of the question.
Yeah.
I definitely think so. I mean, despite bumps on the way, I think life has become better. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, because the things that you know, don't kill you will obviously make you stronger in a way.
Yeah.
Giving you more flesh on your bones.
Yeah. So you're more optimistic about where we are going.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. And I'm really enjoying my life situation.
Yeah.
You know, both personally and on the career side of things, I'm really satisfied.
Great.
Happy.
Great. What really pisses you off?
Unprofessionalism. When people don't deliver what they should or what was expected from them.
Okay. And where do you see this the most?
Well, I mean, it's and I'm really trying to work on that, not to get pissed when I'm in those situations, because
Zen.
Because yes, exactly, just relax, because sometimes most people don't do it deliberately, but you kind of, you know, if it's, I don't know, a baker that bakes a bad bread, you know, you should bake a good bread. You're a baker.
Yeah.
And so everything from that to record companies and record labels that don't kind of live up to what was expected and agreed on.
Train company, airline, airline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, et cetera.
Yeah, et cetera. Okay.
It's those... and also going really hard on myself when I feel that I don't deliver what I should. When I've been unprofessional.
Okay.
So I'm trying to work with that and smooth it out a bit and think that, you know, also that if you really tried your best, then that's good enough.
Yeah.
And maybe this person that you get pissed at also tried his or her best.
Yeah.
So just chill.
Just chill. Okay.
Yeah.
What happens after you die to you?
Well, I think I will see myself from above, because I had, and I think I had this experience after the plane crash when we were lying in the hospital, and my little brother and I, we were across each other in two beds, and I was quite severely injured. So. And I don't know if I've been dreaming this or just making it up in my head or if I actually experienced it, seeing my little brother and me from above.
Okay.
But let's say that I was so drugged on the morphine.
Yeah.
But let's say that I didn't make this up. And it happened.
Yeah.
So then I will probably experience that again when I die.
Ah.
To see everything from above.
You're the first one in this podcast series to have this answer, which is kind of logical, you know, in a sense. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Thanks for this chat.
Thanks for having me, Iro.
Is there something you want to add? Or have we spoken everything? I think we have.
I think we've been around.
Yeah. A good circle in 1 hour, 10 minutes. Thank you so much. And people, subscribe. And every second Saturday there will be a new episode. And make a comment, make a request for a guest. And I'll be seeing you. Thanks.